Welcome to Discovery 2, Module 7. Now, on the off chance, has anybody read the notes? Anybody at all? Okay. Alright. Discovery 2, Module 7, relates to ISP services. And of course it goes without saying that everybody will at least read the notes after I've finished, or at least pretend they have. Yep. Good.
Well, we want to pass.
Oh, good. Okay, well, that makes me happy. ISP
services. Actually, I started, but...
Fair enough. That's all right. Look, we don't always get to these things in quite the time that we would like to. I was busy making notes about this lecture this morning, so I'll put my hand up to being unorganised. Okay, now the help desk technician must understand the services that the ISP provides. Now that might seem like a pretty simple statement, but you'd be surprised at how many help desk technicians don't even know what their ISP does. And once you get them past the level one set of things that they've got the scripts for to fix on people's computers, they really have trouble with some of the higher level stuff or even what the ISP provides. And I think this is probably getting better than it has been previously, but historically speaking, can somebody is Leon in the lecture theatre?
I can check
you.
I hope I am.
Yeah, you are.
Good.
Just checking. One of the problems you can find is that what you used to find when you'd ring up the ISP is if you didn't have a problem with clicking, if you're thing wasn't, click box B and then do this and then do this, they then put you through to sales. And what I used to find, at least with a lot of the ISPs back about 10 years ago, was that sales knew all about what everything costed but nothing about what anything did. And the technicians knew everything about what everything did and nothing about what anything costed. One of the other things that's probably worth mentioning, and we'll mention it up front here on the lecture as far as help desks and things are concerned, just because it's worth mentioning. One would hope that if you are working on a help desk that you speak the native language of the country fairly well. Unfortunately, this no longer seems to be the case over here.
And try not to do it over
I could tell you a joke
line.
About that, but maybe I shouldn't.
Possibly... it depends on how offensive it is. I don't know how much sound editing I want to be able to be doing here. And hello, Saprita.
Hello.
That's all good. We're starting on Discovery 2, Module 7, and we're just saying that the ISPs provide various services, and it helps if the help desk people know what the services are. Okay. The help desk people also must understand, well, theoretically, the services and the underlying protocols so that they can help debug the problems that the user is having. Has anybody had an experience with a not-too-useful help desk technician?
Oh, okay.
Of course.
Oh, dear. Actually, just very quickly, I got told by a help desk technician very, very recently that I couldn't possibly... have an IP address yet. I was on the net at the time, though, so you worked that one out.
Ah, like the ones where your ADSL service gets provisioned and you've already authenticated with their Radius server, which just for Leon's benefit is Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service. That's Radius. And you've already authenticated and you're, on Facebook, as we happened to be talking about earlier, and they go, no, you're not online yet. You go, oh, aren't I? Okay, cool, no problem. You just keep believing that.
It was a little bit more simpler than that. I was just on my first day with my new ISP, and I'd asked for a static IP address and noticed I was in a dynamic pool. And she said, oh, you can't have an IP address yet because your account's not set up. I said, well, I'm on the net. I've obviously got some IP address.
Okay, let's turn the question around. Has anybody actually had a good help desk technician?
Oh, yeah.
Actually, yes, I have.
Yeah, I have too.
The same ISP with the dodgy one, so let's be fair.
Fantastic customer service.
Yeah, that's because their computers are so horrific.
Who does? Who has the fantastic customer
Gateway.
Service?
Gateway.
Oh, right, okay. They need the customer service, do they?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, it's been there, done that.
Actually, I had one with Western Digital who was really good.
I actually had one. I actually rang the States to ask Western Digital about a problem that they were having. I was having with one of their hard drives, and you know, first question he asked me was, "Have you tried using the online tech support services?" I'm like, "Yes." Do you really think I would call the States before trying the online tech support? He said, well, sir, you'd be surprised what people do. I'm like, it's all right, mate. I've tried the online support resources first, and no, it's not in there. Otherwise, I wouldn't be calling you. This was back when calls to the States were quite expensive, a couple of dollars a minute. But yeah, the ones at Western Digital are actually quite good. Except for the fact that they tried to tell me that none of their drives thermally recalibrated. Well, I don't believe that, but that's okay. Okay, back to lecture content. So, I mean, and I think we could safely say, in a lot of instances, that the ISP's PR staff, in this competitive, cutthroat industry, will make or break an ISP. And I think it was quite a number of years ago, and I couldn't exactly say how many years ago, because I don't want the lawyers to come after me, but I think must have been about 5 or 6 years ago that TPG was voted to have the worst tech support in APC. Did you remember that at least, or did you not see that article?
I never saw the article, but I wouldn't be surprised, because when our friends here in Melbourne was on first went under that ISP, and we will mention it, because I'm about to tell you something different from that now, so we can say that their tech support has gotten better. Yes, it was one of the things that they told me, that you just virtually get no support. And it was okay for these guys, because, well, you know who I'm talking about, our friends here in Melbourne, they're techo people, so they can fix their own problems up. But, you know, if you're just a novice user and want to get on, that back in sort of 2004, 2005, they were not the ISP to choose. These days they are better, I have to say. We were logging a support call yesterday about some, which I'll talk to you off channel, about some packet loss on VoIP. And the guy I got was actually pretty good. But anyway, more on that another time. So they have certainly picked up their game.
Excellent. And look, I think you could say that and I've seen this actually, the tech support that the org, this is not quite what Module 7's about, but hey, it'll do, and we will get to the rest of Module 7.
It's real life.
Yeah, it is. I prefer to talk about things that actually, that people are interested in, people have had experience with, rather than actually, you know, pulling every single point out of the notes and, you know, read. I don't need to read the notes to you. You can all read the notes. If you can't read the notes, then, you know. Actually, just on a very short sidetrack, has anybody tried the recorded lecture of ITE 1, Module 1, that we dumped out from the text notes on the site? Has anybody pulled that MP3 down and had a listen?
I've pulled down the MP3, but I haven't had a listen. My apologies.
Oh, okay, one of our students said he found that quite handy, because he actually has that playing in the background, and then he has his notes open, and he tracks along with his eyes as it reads out. So that's certainly something that he was interested in.
Well, I've listened to so many lecture notes on the Victor Reader. It's I'm quite used to, you know, synthesised voices reading these things out, and I find that quite useful. Put the earbuds in when you go for a walk and listen to a cabby note. Anyway, back to what you were saying, Kerry.
Okay, so I've seen that the tech support can either make or break the ISP. And if you speak to people who've ever had to ring up some sort of phone-in service like tech support or whatever, you find that people get very passionate and upset and angry and stuff. Or very happy and stuff, depending on their experiences with tech support. For example, have you ever heard somebody say, "Oh, I spent a beautiful morning on hold to Centrelink. I enjoyed it so much. I'll have to do it again sometime." Centrelink being our version of Social Security.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of things to keep in mind, and we'll mention this very briefly. One is that a lot of the time you are speaking to a human at the other end of the phone. It may not seem so, but you are. And I have personally found that if you interact nicely with human at other end of the phone, it will often make your problems easier to solve, and it will certainly keep your stress levels and blood pressure down, because once people tend to get stressed, things can get a bit crazy on these calls.
The other thing is it sets the help desk person up to want to help you, so they'll go that little bit further than they might have otherwise.
Yes. Yes, and one of my other one of my key techniques is when you ring up, say for example, the biggest telco in the country, we won't name them, and you say, "Can we have XYZ done?" and they go, "No, we can't do that." I sort of smile and say, "Well, what can we do?" And often you'll get some you'll actually get some people actually looking for some solutions for you, rather than just cutting you off with the "No, I can't do that. You can't do that." So, I mean, it's a two-sided thing. As a help desk technician, you've got to be able to interact with the customers and deal with the irate and the cranky customers. And you've also got to be able to, as an end user, utilise tech support as well as possible. If you are ringing up tech support and you do happen to want to be helped with something, being in front of your computer would help a lot. Nobody sort of wants you to ring up and you're sort of, "Oh, no, I'm on a surfboard in Hawaii. I could probably check that when I get home." I mean, what's the good of that? One, you're not on the internet right now because you're surfing in Hawaii. And two, you're not in front of the gear that's actually malfunctioning. Make sure that the gear is accessible to you. Make sure you have all the particulars on the gear. That you're asking about, and make sure that you have in your mind what it is the problem is and stuff, because that makes their job a lot easier. Hopefully, as a student who's come from this course, you should be able to do a little bit better than "the internet isn't working." Well, I'm sure for a lot of people the internet probably is still working. My computer's just made disturbing clicking noises. All right. I am still transmitting.
Yep, you're good.
Love to know what's fired up hundreds of windows. That's not cool. Okay. There are various market sizes. You've got your home user market, you've got your small to medium businesses, and you've got your big corporations and stuff. Now, there are various levels of services that the ISP can provide. They can either provide connectivity services to home users, or for certain businesses and stuff, they can provide either completely hosted services, or they can provide managed services. So what you've got is you've got a situation where the fully hosted services, the whole shebang, is hosted at the ISP, and the ISP looks after it. And then you've also got a situation where the services are hosted at the ISP, but the company actually looks after the services or has the ability to admin those services. And we call those managed services. Can anybody tell me the three-letter acronym that refers to how much help and support you're going to get with your agreement with your ISP? Does anybody know?
SLA?
Yep.
Service Level Agreement.
That's the one. And it tells you how much service you can expect to get from your ISP, how long it's going to take them to fix things, and all those sorts of good things, in theory. Increased customer expectations make ISPs more competitive. People are getting fussier. They want their internet. It is now a key service. I have actually seen people get rather distraught when their internet is not working. What else are we going to do on a Saturday morning? I was just about to spend my Saturday morning on Facebook, Twitter and MySpace. Now I might actually have to go out and mow the lawn. What shall I do now? So obviously ISP reliability, but even more so for businesses who are actually relying on their services to conduct their day-to-day business. You've got all sorts of services there. For example, you've got email, web hosting, media streaming, voice over IP, just a very quick diversion. Has anybody noticed, more to the Australian users, I think Telstra and stuff are starting to shovel calls over voice over IP, because I've noticed that when people make certain noises and stuff, it actually sends a DTMF hash mark. You know, like on the Superiors?
Yeah, they do. Lots of them are. And even a lot of places you ring up are using these, like reception type, I guess you could say virtual reception services, like you ring up an organisation. Can I speak to Joe Pogs? Oh, yes, putting you through now. And can I ask who's calling in there? I'm the most cruddiest VoIP blonde I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's a real problem. Especially it makes it really difficult to understand them and stuff. Of course, this is the point at which I point out that if you've got a machine, you can set up your own interactive voice response system for the cost of the little machine, 60 to 80 gig of hard disk space, and there is an automatic install option for blind people, and it's called PBX in a Flash, www.pbxinaflash.net. And you can set up all sorts of call forward, inbound call stuff. You can bring your phone into it. You can dial out with it. You can do direct IP dialing, which is something the Melbourne crew are very happy about. All that sort of stuff. Or you can just avail yourself of a Sapura, whatever the latest model is, SPA3102, and hook a phone in one side and your internet connection in the other and do your VoIP stuff that way.
So does it require a hardware device?
No. Well, to bring your phone line in, it does. If you want to bring your phone line in, you've got to have some sort of hardware device to bring your phone line in, and you can actually wire your phone line into the incoming PABX and handle either incoming VoIP calls and incoming PSTN calls, which stands for Public Switch Telephone Network, or you can just do VoIP stuff. And if you're just doing VoIP stuff, you don't actually need a hardware device. You can just use, say, SJ Phone under Windows to talk to the PABX. And it's all configurable through a web browser. That sometimes makes people happy.
We got a Linux equivalent to all this?
That is Linux. PBX in a Flash runs CentOS.
Oh, okay. So I could put that on my Fedora box, maybe?
I think you actually need to be running CentOS to actually compile up the PBX in a Flash stuff. There are other free asterisk implementations that can be dropped onto different Linux boxes. I saw one the other day, which I've just completely forgotten the name of. I'm sure
you can find one. It's on the to-do list. There's a few of us here who actually want to do it. And I've got about 20 applications for it when I do actually do it, so it'll be rather handy to have.
Did you ever do a
Thursday chat or anything on that? I guess we're not really doing Thursday chats now, but
we should lobby the powers that be harder, I think, Jackie.
Well, I reckon here's my money making scheme. I reckon if all the students pull together and make a donation, we can have a special Thursday chat. And of course, that's not really fair, but it would be a nice thought. I don't know. We might have to start doing some unofficial podcasts or something. I did do one on VoIP. But I haven't actually done anything on the actual setting up of PBX in a Flash and stuff. There's all sorts of things we could be doing. We could be doing podcasts on. And I don't think it's up on Blind Cool Tech yet. Don't think anybody's done one.
No, they haven't.
Doing a Sapura configuration many years ago on it, but that's about it.
Oh, that was painful.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I can't remember the guy's name, but it was hard.
Well, he basically sat there for 20 minutes telling me that he didn't know what all these options did, and I'm like, well, mate, I do, because I read the book, but whatever, okay? Fast forward. Okay, you're not going to tell me how to do direct IP dialing after all. Okay. Anyway, we digress. We probably will talk about that at some point, because, I mean, that could be quite a money-spinning venture if you could set up little PABXs for things. And not to put too fine a point on it, I mean, often there are lots of churches and stuff that could do with a little PABX with, like, you know, voicemail and answering machine and all that sort of stuff, and you could save people a packet. Anyway, that's my money-making idea for the day. If you've got an EE box, you can also run the PABX in a virtual machine, just so you know. There's a few little tricks you've got to go through to make it happen, but you can actually virtualize PBX in a Flash if that's something you want to do.
I'm sorry, did you say an EE box?
Yeah, they're like, a bit like a Walmart green PC.
I think over here they call them E-machines, maybe?
Yeah, they probably do. There's also that Walmart Greenpeace C or whatever they put out, that apparently runs PABX in a flash really nicely.
Yeah, I'd really be interested in finding more out about how that works.
Absolutely. I've dabbled with it, and I did have it working at one point. One of the cool things that we had set up was actually that if you had your Bluetooth on your mobile phone turned on and you wandered into range of the PABX, you could automatically make VoIP calls out over the PABX, which we thought was pretty cool. Okay, the next thing we have to talk about today is reliability and availability. Availability is whether you can get to it or not, and reliability is whether or not it's up when you want it to be up. As a matter of case in point about bad availability, we actually had a local bank, I won't say which one, that used to do their maintenance between 8 and 12 on Saturday night. Now, if you ask me, that's pretty stupid because most people I know wanted to check their bank account on those particular, you know, you want to know how much money you've got in your account Saturday night before you go out. But no, their banking site was down for maintenance. Now, there are two ways of measuring reliability. One is the mean time before failure, the mean time before bang fizz. But seriously, they measure that by testing units until they fail, and then they do a statistical average as to how soon or whatever stuff will fail. It's not really reliably measured for things like hard drives and stuff because you really don't know. They actually say that electronic components basically have what we call a bathtub curve. If you plot the likelihood of failure against the time axis, which is on the, I always get these wrong, the horizontal one, that's the Y, I think.
Y
climb up. Okay, I'll remember it that way. Okay, so on the x-axis you've got time, and on the y-axis you've got the failure. And it's actually a bathtub curve, so it sort of starts up really high at the beginning of its lifetime, sort of drops off, goes down, along, and then as the component ages and gets older and older, then the likelihood of failure increases. And I don't know if anybody's noticed, but usually if you get like a new hard drive or a new computer or whatever, they'll either bang in the first couple of weeks, or they'll last for ages and ages and ages, and then eventually go bang. Has anybody experienced that?
I guess I've been lucky.
Yeah, I had it happen once. I got one in 2 days. It went and died on me.
Okie dokie. And then you've got mean time to repair is how long it's going to take them to get it back to you. Now, I actually had a positive experience with Netgear the other day, which is a bit surprising. No, they seriously have picked up their act a lot. They had to. I had some Netgear switches that were malfunctioning, and I was offered a couple of options. I could either send back the switches to them and they would send me new switches, or for, I think it was $40 or $50 a switch, they would send me new ones, and then I would send the old ones back, and then if I didn't send the old ones back, they would bill me for the replacement cost of the rest of the value of the switches, and I had provided my credit card details so that they could do that. And for a lot of people, that's very handy, especially when you live in Perth and everything takes a week to get anywhere. You don't want to be shipping back the ones you've got at the moment if they're kind of working, unless you can get some sort of advanced ones. So that was very cool. So the time they took to repair it didn't really bother me because they'd already shipped me new ones. Interestingly enough, though, Netgear didn't want me to send back any of the power supplies, so I now have two more 12-volt, 1-amp power bricks, which don't do anybody any good, but they're just stacking up on my shelf. So there you go. The other thing that's a bit disturbing, I think everybody's kind of noticed this, has anybody noticed how all of these devices have these whopping big brick sort of power supplies that aren't a switch mode?
Anchors away!
Pretty much.
Yep.
I remember there was sort of a, back in the old days, people used to heave bricks through windows. I reckon these power supplies would be the second best thing. But they are, you know, big and heavy, and I've also noticed that somebody's finally come up with some spaced power boards so that you can actually fit more than one brick on the particular power strip that you've got. Okay. Now, ISPs, they obviously want reliability. If they're not reliable, people drop off their list like flies. They really do. If your ISP becomes flaky and the service goes up and down, there's only so much of that users will put up with. Because sort of one of the reasons why some of the ISPs over here lock people into contracts to try and stop them from jumping between ISPs. Certain telecommunication companies tend to like locking you into 12 and 24 month contracts with deals that say, well, for the first 6 months you'll only pay half price, and then for the next 18 months you'll pay the regular price. And believe it or not, it works. I have seen people getting stung by this.
Yep. And they're usually the ones that don't have the best value for money either.
This is exactly right.
I'll catch you later. Come off for lunch.
No worries, enjoy lunch.
Not going to ring them up at 3 o'clock in the morning to say your ISP's your router's not working, but that's really not good value for money when it, you know, sort of other things go wrong.
Yeah, pretty much. A note that we're transitioning across to a new server later today. So if QCAT.org dies horribly in strange ways, we need to know about it because we're moving it across onto the X-Serve that's actually got RAID and eventually backup. Ooh, what a concept. We do have backup on the current one, actually. And we'll be moving that over sort of as of midday our time, so if stuff breaks, let us know. Well, don't complain straight away, email us, and then complain a bit later. Also, I need to know, I think I've still got the email, but let me know which certificate you're missing, Jackie, after lecture. And I think I actually requested one for you, so I'll dig it out of my email and forward it to you, because that's the nice sort of guy that I am. You will eventually get a signed one. We'll post those over and sort that out. I think we've only got one Discovery student left in the US, so we'll post yours over to you.
Would that be me?
I think you're it. The other US student we've got, we imported over here. She's sitting next to me.
Yep, I know.
Yeah, you want to watch it. You get imported if you join these courses.
They don't want me.
Away like that, children.
You're welcome anytime.
Okay, now availability is measured in percentage. And it's obviously 100% is up all the time. People expect phone systems to be up 99.999% of the time. Yeah, right. Anybody ever tried to make a call on a prepaid mobile on a Saturday night? It's not going to happen very often, because everybody is out on the prepaid networks and they just saturate. Are you on contract, Elise, or prepaid, just out of morbid curiosity?
I'm actually on, free and easy, where you can just sort of pay month by month. I served my time under contract, and I'm just on a casual plan, I suppose you call it. I thought the prepaids used the same network as the regular people do, but they just had different phone numbers.
I was actually told by the Optus Boost people that there was more availability set aside for the contract people, and I've noticed the internet and stuff on contract is faster, yeah.
Yeah, like I'm on month by month. I'm actually on a contract with my mobile internet, and I ported the phone across to Optus just so that I could get the cheaper wireless internet when I'm out and about, that's all.
So you're on every now and then or whatever, or one of those sorts of plans?
Oh, I don't know what they call it, but yeah, well, yeah, something like that. So I could move the phone away, but if I did that, the cost of my contract, which is a mobile broadband, you know, USB come wireless gadget thingy I'll bring to Perth, a bit like your 3-1, will go up.
Ah, excellent. Well, not excellent if it went up, but yeah, that's an excellent situation you have there. They expect phone systems to be up 99.999% of the time. And I would just like to make a side point here that in my not-so-humbled opinion, choosing a mobile phone plan slash contract is just slightly more complex than open-heart surgery these days. It's really, really
not meant
difficult.
To be easy to understand.
I think it depends on which company you're looking at their website for.
Oh, they're all complex enough.
They're all hard.
No, you've got to know what restrictions are what's considered premium content, what's not considered premium content. And, I mean, Vodafone doesn't tend to jargonise it up enough, but they still split it out, whereas Optus, you've got my money, my funky money, my souped-up power money, you know, whatever. So, very complex. So if you're doing service delivery, don't confuse your customers if you can help it. Okay. Now, the rest of these notes. Can anybody tell me what the four layers, or can anybody give me one of the four layers in the TCP/IP model is? We'll work from the bottom.
Internet?
That's not the bottom, but that's one of the layers.
Well, there's internet, there's transport, there's... I just drew a blank.
Application.
That's the one I forget.
Yeah, application, yeah. And there's one more.
Network.
Network access.
Ah, yeah, I knew I was close with network.
If it makes you all feel any better, sometimes I forget what they are too.
It's funny, the TCP, the OSI one sticks better in my mind than the TCP one. There you go.
Me
there's
too,
more layers on that.
It's probably because of the you have a mnemonic. Don't throw a sausage pizza. Sausage pizza.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I had one of my TAFE students once ask me when I walked into class in about Lecture 3, they're just sort of like, do we have to know all the stuff that you know? And I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, good, I was a bit worried there for a minute. But no, I forget the layers too, so don't worry too much about it. Well, you should probably know them, but you know, worrying too much about them isn't going to be constructive.
Well, it's always you know the information if you've got it in your notes.
Yes and no. I think if you're going for a networking job and you get to sit a technicals test, some of the technicals tests don't allow you access to the internet.
Indeed.
And in fact, if you go, if you sort of walk into the job thing and go, oh, yeah, there's that ISO layer model thing, like the cake with the networky accessy stuff, and you just use like the layers to fix it. Maybe your application might not be the top of the stack. So you need a certain level of base knowledge to be able to, to get yourself out of these situations. Yes, research is very important, but a base level of knowledge is also very useful, especially when the internet isn't available, which is often when your services will be called upon. I must say that it's very entertaining to see this young generation of technicians come to a dead stop when the internet connection's down. Yes, and it's quite humorous. Back in my day, we didn't have the internet, ... Okay. Now, these notes go through the two different types of protocols that are in TCP/IP. Can somebody tell me what one of the protocols is called? This is not really a trick question.
IP and transport.
Yep, there's IP, yep. And TCP stands for?
Transmission Control Protocol.
Okay, and does anybody know the fundamental difference between TCP and UDP?
I do.
It's reliability.
It is, one of them is reliability, but what were you going to say, Grace?
End-to-end connection TCP. Versus...
Yeah, connection versus, yeah. What were you going to say, Grace?
TCP is reliable, but not as fast, and UDP is faster, but it doesn't have any kind of error checking, so if a packet's dropped, it's gone.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'd agree with the not as fast. I suppose if you're looking at it from a raw speed perspective, you might be a few bytes slower with TCP. But with the advanced windows and scaling, I wouldn't say speed is exactly the... certainly less overhead, though. So basically, yeah, UDP is fire and forget, a bit like a cannon.
Warren, did you get a lot?
And
connectionless was the word I was looking for. Duh.
Yes, UDP is connectionless. And, for example, what is the... Which subset of protocols does voice over IP generally use?
UDP.
UDP, which is why we're getting dropouts on a well-popular internet service provider at the moment. No checking. It's just fire and forget.
Pretty much. Which leads me on to an interesting lecture about traffic control and traffic shaping and all that sort of stuff, which we won't even get started on. But that would be another one we could have a Thursday chat on, quality of service. Maybe the Thursday chats will come back one day. Now, let's see. So, TCP connection-oriented to UDP connectionless. How do the computers know which service is being requested if you open a connection?
Socket, application, port number.
Yep, socket or port number. And apparently the port number is actually, the socket is what actually listens, and although you do have a send and receive socket, and then you have a send and receive port number, and we've been through that in Discovery 1, but it's very important. That's how you can multiplex, which is our funky word for putting multiple connections along the one communications channel. There is a really good resource that will tell you what all the different ports are on www.grc.com. Gibson Research Corporation, he's the bloke who makes SpinRite, which has saved my bacon on quite a number of occasions. Or you can key in TCP space port space and the number into Google, and you'll probably land on his site anyway, because he tends to categorize them. This can often be useful if you're trying to figure out what is eating up all of the connections through your router, who's running file sharing on your network, that sort of good stuff. Interestingly enough, I cannot receive any traffic on ports 6881 to 6999, although my ISP swears black and blue that they are not blocking torrents, so go figure.
You don't have any malware on your machine, do you?
No. I actually did check. And in fact, I tried it on the Linux box as well, and I actually fired up TCP dump to actually watch whether the packets were going out and coming back. And I can tell you that none of the packets were coming out, but they were coming back, but they were certainly being sent out on those ports correctly.
Interesting.
That's okay. I didn't bother changing. I didn't bother chasing it up because I just moved the ports down into a different range and it all went like a mad thing. So it's all good. However, I do remember that Comcast were actually blocking torrents altogether. If they detected you were running BitTorrent, they would just drop the packets on the floor. So they really weren't very, which was fine for 90% of the people who were breaking the law. They shouldn't have been torrenting anyway. But it did upset people like Blizzard Entertainment and stuff that do actually distribute their game updates via torrent. Legitimately. Okay, now when you're using TCP, the notes say here that basically it bundles all of the octets up into segments. These segments are then sequenced and sent over the link, and then at the other end they are decapsulated. Okay, so I don't think anybody's got any questions on any of that sort of stuff so far. It's all pretty much revision from last discovery course, I should say. Anybody got anything they want to know about basic TCP, UDP, port numbers, that sort of stuff at this point in time, or is everybody relatively happy?
I'm all right.
Now, before a TCP session is established, the hosts actually need to set up the connection, and this is called the three-way handshake. And as I usually refer to it, it's like, oi, I want to talk to you. Who, me? Yeah, you. Okay, three-way handshake. So the first host sends a synchronization message to begin the synchronization of the connection. Now, one of the problems is that you used to be able to guess sequence numbers, and this could cause you to be able to spoof messages coming from a host by guessing what the next sequence numbers would be and then feeding the packets through. So now, most implementations of TCP IP protocol stacks tend to start with random synchronization numbers, which is fine because the SYN packet tells you where you're starting from. So it indicates the intention of the source host to send information over the connection, and it synchronizes the sequence numbers so that you know which number you're starting at and before you're monatomically incrementing. Ooh. Or you're just making the sequence number bigger by one. Why use a small word when a diminutive one will do? That's what I always say. And you can actually watch, you know, synchronize those sequence numbers. Now, has anybody ever heard of an attack called SYN flooding?
Yeah.
That's S-Y-N, not S-I-N. Just clarifying that. It's where you send a whole lot of synchronization packets, and the remote server keeps a whole lot of tries to send back acknowledgement packets, and it keeps a whole stack of connections and sockets open, waiting for the next packets to show up. And it's one of the denial of service attacks that can fill up the connection table and take you down. So basically your SYN message goes out, your remote host sends an ACK message back to you, then the sending host actually sends an ACK message back to say, yep, the connection is open and we're off and away. And there's a whole lot of stuff here about how it goes down and resolves all this stuff, so I'd check your notes for that. Okay, now your receiving host sends a whole stack, spends a whole set. Start that sentence again. The receiving host stores a whole stack of packets in a receive buffer, and it uses the sequence numbers to order the packets, because it is quite possible for the packets to turn up out of order, especially if it's being relayed over multiple links of different speeds and reliability qualities. Now, this is important because if you are using voice over IP and you were to run it over a TCP connection and there was a little bit of a network hiccup, your combination would stop dead until the problem was resolved and stuff, and you'd be buffering up all this data and all that sort of good stuff, which is why we use UDP, which means it's less reliable, but it does mean that the conversation can survive some network hiccups. Now, there are timers that say that if you haven't received a packet in a certain amount of time, you're going to resend the packet, and then there is an exponential back-off algorithm that will actually increase the retry time exponentially each time there is a transmission failure. This is to stop the network from being flooded with bad packets. Now, have I been through... I'm pretty sure I have been through how DNS works. Is everybody happy with how DNS works? Well, relatively speaking.
Yep.
Does anybody have any questions on DNS that they want answered? That would interest them. Like, so if I sent you all off to go and register www.fuzzybouncybunnies.com, you'd all be happy to do that? No, seriously. But anybody got any questions on DNS they want to know about? I'll put one question out there. How does your DNS resolver know how to start looking up domains? Does anybody know?
Your DNS server should be set in your when you get an IP address usually.
But then it goes to the root server. It goes to a root server that knows everything about the root domains, like .com and .edu and .au and stuff. And then the root server kind of steers them from there as to which server has the actual address that it needs to look up.
That is correct. And in fact, if you are running a name server yourself and you don't have the ISP's name service to fall back on, or you're not using OpenDNS for some reason, you actually have to prime your DNS resolver with a list of root name servers. And once you've done that, it's actually got the names and IP addresses of all those root servers, and that allows it to ask its way back up through the domain tree, so you know about com and all that sort of stuff.
So is there like a database that you can download from the internet or somewhere in order to do that?
Yeah, there is. Generally speaking, the list of authoritative root name servers is distributed with copies of Bind, or the Berkeley Internet named name daemon, which is the copy of which is the stuff that usually runs on Macs and Linux and stuff to do the DNS resolvers. But I think there is a list of root name servers on. They used to be on rs.internic.net, but I'm not sure where they are now. I'd have to probably Google for authoritative list of root name servers. I think they're actually called a.gtld.net or whatever, all the way through to L. But yeah, there will be a list of them out there somewhere. That assumes, of course, you've got an ability to surf the internet and look that information up, because obviously without your DNS, you're not going to get very far on the particular machine that you're trying to prime. But yeah, it's usually distributed with Bind. And they've actually standardized the names and stuff so that they're not likely to change anytime soon to allow them to continue working. Okay, now there's interesting bits of information here which is worth knowing about. It shows the difference between the TCP segment and the UDP datagrams. So you've got 20 bytes of overhead for a TCP segment. So you've got source port, which is 16 bits. 16 bits for a destination port. 32-bit sequence number. 32-bit acknowledgement number. The header length, which is 4 bytes. Reserved, which is 6. Code bits, which is 6. And window, which is 16 bits. And 16-bit checksum. Urgent stuff, which is 16-bit field. And the options, which is 0 bits or 32 bits, depending on whether the option field is filled in. And then the size of the application layer varies. And then you've got 8 bytes of overhead for the UDP datagram. You've got 16 bits for the source port, 16 bits for the destination port, 16 bits for the length, and 16 bits for the checksum. So as you can see, there is a lot more overhead for TCP than there is for UDP. Now, basically, the rest of the notes are all about port. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, although a lot of the times the TCP packets tend to be a little bit smaller just because of the data that's contained in them, as opposed to, like, UDP that's voice and video and stuff like that, that the datagrams tend to be a bit large.
Yeah, they can be, although it is also possible, depending on how the application works, that you get a whole stack of little UDP packets being sent over because the stuff that's going over isn't being streamed that quickly or whatever. Whereas with TCP, they try to fill the packets up because of the overhead. But that all depends on the implementation. But yeah, you're probably right. Then obviously the rest of these notes basically go on about port numbers. I'm just scrolling down here. We talk about sockets, which is basically the combination of the source IP address and source port number, or the destin IP address and destination port number, which is known as a source socket and a destination socket, respectively. Netstat-B is kind of useful under Windows. It will actually show you what connections are established and which application is supposedly using that connection. So if anybody wants to try Netstat-B after the lecture, it's very handy.
Could you trap Trojans that might be open connections?
Oh, what is the JQS.X? I gotta look that up.
Don't know.
Isn't that like a JAWS thing?
I don't think so. That would be something along the lines of FS, probably, or JFW.
No, I thought there used to be... There used to be things like SQCPS was the name of their old copy protection, and there was other sorts of things. But I'm sure a quick Google will find us what JQS is in short order. And in fact, that's probably something students should probably do at some point, is if they're not sure of what things are actually running on their computer and stuff, they should probably have a look at netstat-b and find out what sort of things they do have open and what sort of things are... Welcome back, Geraldine. Now, obviously services are enabled by software that is installed on the server. Funny that. You do actually have to explain that to some people. The other thing that's worth explaining to people is if you're going to set up a web server, don't call it www. Like, really. We don't need a machine called www. The reason you don't want a machine called www is, one, because it's hard to say, but secondly, because if you want to change the machine that you're running your www stuff on, you then have to change DNS records, and it takes time for that to propagate. What the best thing to do is to actually call the machine something sensible and then have what we call a canonical name record, which points from www to the actual host name. And in fact, one of the little jokes that the person that I used to work with on the ISP back in 97 used to do was he would come up with funny names for all of the domain names that they would use. And we actually had a domain called useit.com.au, useit.com.au, and he set up the C name for www.useit.com.au to point to won't.useit.com.au. And one of the customers was doing a test, and the customer's like, "What's this? W-O-N-T, what do you mean won't use it.com.au? And my friend thought very quickly and went, "Oh, that stands for Wide Area Operations Network Test." And the guy's like, oh, okay, good. They're canonical name records, and they allow you to point a www record at a different machine so that when your web server crashes on one machine, you can just redirect the canonical name record and you can point it to another machine. So if you're setting up a website, I'd really recommend that you use canonical name records rather than actually using an A record pointing directly at www.
Can I interrupt for a minute?
Yes, you certainly can.
Java Quick Starter.
You've got Java installed.
Yes, and it wants to update every now and again, I think. Sits there hooked up to the internet waiting for its chance to pounce.
Once every 3 months or so.
It depends on how many bugs have been exposed in Java as to whether they release a new update.
I guess the only reason I was interested was because I've been experiencing a bunch of kernel exceptions lately, and I'm trying to troubleshoot that.
Is it .NET framework in Java?
Maybe kernel exceptions, perhaps. My experience is either with kernel exceptions is usually corrupted operating system files or bad hardware. And let's hope it's neither of those two things. Okay, now some of the services that the ISP can provide are email hosting, website hosting, e-commerce sites, file storage and transfer, message boards and blogs, and streaming video and audio services. And obviously a lot of these protocols, HTTP, FTP and stuff, underpin these services that the ISP can provide to you. It pays to shop around. You could often get widely varying prices. There are some people who will tell you that it's $110 a year to have your domain hosted, and other people that will tell you that it's $510 a year to have your domain hosting done. So it depends on who you shop through and what sort of level of service you want. It's all well and good to say, for example, for some of the hosting companies to host your domains somewhere in America, but if you're not up to call them up to ask for technical support, it can be a little inconvenient. So some people actually choose to host in, say, Australian companies if we're in Australia, because you can actually call them in regular business hours. That said, companies like GoDaddy.com in the US are open 24 hours a day, so that sort of nullifies that sort of
And they're really cheap.
Yes, but I think their site is still fairly inaccessible, so you have to ring them up for everything.
The thing is, also, it depends on what part of the world you're in. Obviously, we've got some American people here, but if you're in Australia and you're trying to pitch your website to an Australian audience, you really want your website to be hosted in Australia. I know it's about a tenth of the price if you get it hosted in some big rack space place in America that's got some server room deep in the bowels of some mountain, but honestly, it's not good.
I've actually noticed, though, a lot of people have... Sorry, go on, Jackie.
I was just going to say GoDaddy.com is right here in Arizona, so I love it.
Well, it's fine for you. Yeah, that's great.
The only thing that sort of gets me about GoDaddy.com is the amount of things they will try and sell you on checkout. It's like, do you want a blog? Do you want a green pussycat? Would you like the extra upgraded green pussycat package? I'm sure it works for a lot of people, but you've really got to watch out that other things don't turn up in your shopping cart as you check them out.
That's actually an America thing. A lot of sites do it.
Yeah, well, go to packnames.com, PACNAMES.com, and they sell you a domain and nothing else. Bang, 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 straight through the checkout process, and it's far more accessible. And it's the same price as GoDaddy, but be that as it may. I like GoDaddy. But I also find their sites a bit overloaded. I find their tech support staff absolutely excellent. I actually got put through to their credit card fraud department one day, and they said, "Oh, hello, can I help you?" And I said, "Which department is this?" And they're like, "This is actually the credit card fraud department." I'm like, "Wow, I'm really not sure how I've managed to get here, but let's find out." And she said, "Well, it's some incorrect information on the sign up form you filled in. You put WA, you put WA, and you put Australia. Now we all know that WA is Washington." I said, "No." I said, WA, Western Australia, is a bit bigger than Washington.
Several times bigger.
And they managed to refund my money, and I redid my order, and it was all good. But yes, so packnames.com. Packnames I like because it's usable in Lynx, which is a text mode web browser. Now, that's not important for everybody, but it means the site is lean, mean, and it works very, very well. And I've had no problems with them. Packnames.com. I also have stuff through GoDaddy. And while we're talking about funky services, fastmail.fm is pretty cool too. Their IMAP servers are faster than Google's by an order of magnitude.
It depends on what you want, because I'm a reseller of one here in Australia, and some people just simply say, "Can you register the domain for me?" because they don't want to know about it. So I charge them a little bit more for that, because I've got to actually sit down and do it and get their in Australia, you need the Australian business number or the Australian company number if you're registering a .com.au, and I've got to do it and put all that information in, and then I've got to delegate it to whichever host we're using. And so some people, depends on the level of service you want.
Absolutely. In fact, I think you did drunkenfriends.net, didn't you? For one of our
I did do it, but the our friendly drunken net person was savvy enough to do it all for himself. But yes, I would have charged him a little more if he asked me to do it for him. So yes, we are both hosting and the registrar for drunkenfriends. Something or other. Net, I think
net.
It was.
Net.
Drunkenfriends.net. There you go.
That's right, and I would just like to point out at this point, before anybody even goes there in their browser, that it's not work safe, okay? So we told you, don't go there. All sorts of things happen, unless you are happy for non-work safe stuff. Some of the streams are quite calm and peaceful, and some of them aren't so calm and peaceful. So just be aware of that. Yes, now this is the other thing. I mean, you can pay somebody to have all this stuff happen, and you pay Elise N dollars, and she sits down and does it, and it all works, and then you call her up if something goes wrong, and that's what you're paying for. Or you can sit down and do it yourself. But if you are registering your own domains, there's a lot of things you have to go through. You need to have a nick handle, you need to register the domain, you need to delegate the name servers. Oh, is this the point at which I point out that www.zonedit.com will host 5 domains for free for you? That means they'll host your DNS data. That doesn't mean they host your website. So just be aware of that one as well.
We all like that, don't we?
Well, yeah, we do. I do. I've found them very reliable.
Nice. Oh, that's very cool.
We probably want to start making a start on that WhizBang site at some point. The WhizBang list of URLs.
The list of the Kerry host list of URLs. Yes.
Well, they don't always have to be mine. I'm sure everybody else has got some too.
Oh, yeah, the cavi list.
The cavi list.
Like, there's a lot of good stuff. Like the cavi list. Like there's zone edit and DIN DNS for people who are using it, etc., etc.
Well, here's the problem. I mean, everybody has this stuff in their head, and it does nobody else any good there. I mean.
We blindies tend to do that sort of thing, so we've all got very good, most of us are blessed with good memories.
I remember I went out to an airport to meet a good friend of mine, and I turned up with my wife, and the first thing my friend said to me was, what website did you get it from, because I wouldn't mind one. I had to sort of explain to him that no, there wasn't a website where you could get these from. We had a bit of a chuckle, but yeah, no, I agree. It doesn't do you a lot of good if it's in your head, and we'll put them all down at some point and try and categorise them up and hopefully not have them in a complete mess. Okay. It's also possible that we will be getting a wiki up and running on the new server at some point. I don't know whether we'll hold off before we go to Snow Leopard to get the wiki up and running, but we may end up with a QCAT wiki in the next couple of weeks.
That'd be good.
I've been hearing good things about Snow Leopard.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
There's a lot of good stuff in
there. I installed it the other day on my Mac, and the voiceover tutorial is much more complete than the one in Leopard. It's got more screens and stuff and lets you practice the stuff. Although I have heard of, there is the occasional update funny where if you upgrade to Snow Leopard and then your Mac dies horribly, you've got to reset its PRAM, which is the Mac version of CMOS. And there are a few other hiccups in the upgrade process which are apparently known about and that you can work around. But yeah, it's a good bit of kit.
And they say it's not very expensive to update. If you've got Leopard, you can get Snow Leopard very inexpensively, so that's all very good.
$40.
Yep, that's right.
That is quite a deal for an operating system, I must
say. Does anybody know what the retail price on Snow Leopard was? I didn't think it was much more. The retail's $40 anyway.
$39. I don't know, but it's substantial.
$39.10, I think I paid.
I must get a Mac.
Accessibility in it is really very much improved.
What, since Leopard? Or since the other OSs? I know Leopard is pretty good, but they tell me that
it's even better.
It's even better in Snow Leopard, is it? Yeah, well, it's high time I got one.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
I've found that apparently I've just been informed by Mr. Mac that you can get the family edition for $69, which is licensee. So I think it's 69 licenses is put on 5 machines. Now there's where Microsoft went wrong. They don't sell a family bundle because that is really handy.
Yeah.
No, the but it makes you feel Microsoft's better about it.
Going wrong is that Apple put a lot of information out there in the public domain about what Snow Leopard was going to do and was going to be like before it released it. So there's no less likelihood of there being nasty surprises when you actually do put it on.
You can also get a bundle for, I think, $189 or whatever that's got iWork and iLife. And I think iWork is now accessible with VoiceOver.
It is. Yep. I'm using Pages, and that's accessible. I haven't used the others, but, yeah, Pages certainly is.
I would still point out to people that VoiceOver does have a couple of rough edges. The support in terminal buffers is not brilliant. I haven't actually tried it in Snow Leopard yet. And also, if you're reading PDFs with lots of text on the page, sometimes Alex can trip over himself and die horribly. Although VoiceOver is now scriptable in Snow Leopard, I've heard, not only in AppleScript but also in Ruby and Perl. And there is also a nifty piece of AppleScript you can get that will relaunch your VoiceOver for when it dies and Command F5 doesn't work anymore, which is very frustrating for blind people.
I have returned.
Yes, welcome back, Leon.
Thanks, Kerry.
Now, they're talking about HTTP and HTTPS. HTTP is the non-secure version, and HTTPS is the secure version that usually runs on port 443, and the ISP can provide both. It's also worth pointing out here at this particular point that if you're going to do HTTPS, you need to get a certificate, and depending on the certificate you get depends on how much you pay, because usually you buy it from somewhere, like Verizon or Thought, which is not spelt like the way you think, it's spelt a different way. Or you can get a free certificate from www.cacert.org. However, the root certificate for CACERT is not in Internet Explorer. It is, however, in Firefox, so you'd have to add the root certificate in yourself. So sometimes it's just easier to buy yourself a certificate for $100 a year or whatever for your SSL compliant site. Now, as we know, Uniform Resource Locator is made up of a number of components. One is the protocol specifier, then colon, slash slash domain name, optional colon port, and then slash path. Now, with web stuff, you can either have HTTP or HTTPS. Now, I would caution people that if you are going to your internet banking site, or you're going to your PayPal site or whatever, rather than clicking on the link in your email, perhaps it would be a good idea to directly type the URL into the address bar so that you don't get any nasty surprises.
Yes.
And then basically we talk about POP and IMAP. And IMAP is really cool. And if you're not using IMAP with Gmail, if you happen to be a Gmail user, you probably should be. It allows you to keep a consistent view of the messages on all of the computers that you check it from.
Gmail supporting IMAP.
As of about 12 months ago, yes.
Oh, excellent. Does it cost?
No, it's free.
Sorry then for cutting you off. Go ahead and explain what IMAP does for the masses.
That's all right. I will do that. And then you can go and either I can send you a little document that has all of the port numbers and information, or you can go look it up on the Google Help Center. IMAP is what we call Internet Mail Access Protocol, and it allows you to have a consistent view of your messages. The messages are stored on the server rather than on the client. So if you're using the POP protocol, which is a bit of a tautology, if you're using POP, I should say, because it's not the Post Office Protocol, your messages are fetched down onto your computer, and they are then saved on your computer. And I'm sure people have had users where they've got three computers and they set up POP on all of them, and they end up with their messages scattered across all three computers. Anybody had that happen? Isn't it fun? Okay, right. Now with IMAP. With IMAP, you actually have a consistent view of your messages, no matter where you connect from, and all of the message state and stuff is stored on the server. So, you have... there's a couple of ways you can get IMAP. Some ISPs will actually charge you for the privilege of storing your mail, whereas other ones will provide IMAP at no extra cost. Obviously, with POP, the messages are stored temporarily on the ISP, and then they are downloaded onto your computer. As an ISP, we actually took no responsibility for the permanent storage of people's email. And in fact, there were people who ticked that box that said leave messages on server, and they ended up with, 100, 200 megabyte inboxes. And then something would go wrong and they would lose all of their messages, and we would say, sorry, we don't warrant your storage on this server for any more than, temporary storage.
We have that problem with some of our clients who are hosting with us. They tick that box, leave messages on server so they can fetch it on another computer, and they never do. And when their box gets filled up, they complain. Or when they lose a message, they complain. So, we're not responsible for keeping your email unless you have a special arrangement with us.
But Gmail allows you to leave them on the server and also have access.
I think they do let you leave them on there, and generally speaking, it's safe to do so, okay? And generally speaking, they do store your 2 or 3 gig or whatever they say they're going to give you. It's quite a large storage capacity. The only thing I would caution people against with Gmail and those free services is you do get what you pay for. If Gmail decides to delete all of the messages out of your account because they decide they want to, you have no recourse. They're gone. So whilst you can rely on it, and I don't think you're going to have a problem, you are at their whim as to how much storage space or whatever they decide to provide you. And it is possible, for example, for them to cut you back down to 1 gig and then delete all the messages older than day dot. I don't think they will, but it is always a possibility.
Possibility with an ISP too, though.
Generally, the ISP actually has a terms of service that they actually have to adhere to. And also, because you're actually paying money to the ISP, there is a legal liability there because you've actually exchanged money and you're buying a service. So if you sign up with someone like fastmail.fm, they actually have a much bigger guarantee as to how much storage space you're going to get, whether they're going to hang on to your messages, that sort of thing. So you are, it is a more sure thing than, say, for example, using a free service. I don't know whether anybody remembers when Hotmail decided they were implementing quotas and service limits and stuff. They just did it. I mean, they told people about it, but they just did it. But it did inconvenience a lot of people. Also be aware, just for people who are using it, that there are certain attachments and stuff that Gmail will not accept and allow you to send. They don't like zip files, and they don't like a few other things. They don't like exes in zip files and a few other things, so that can be a bit of a something you've got to work around if you're using that service. Generally speaking, I think Gmail's great, but you do have to be aware that it is a free service, and it is up to Google what they will provide to you at any given time. Yeah, handy hint, if you want to get zip files through Gmail, you can rename the files to have a different extension, or encrypt the contents and shovel it through that way, and then the other user can rename it back at the other end. So, look, yeah, we've got nothing against Gmail. Google is an incredibly big service, and they do exceedingly well, but it's also worth noting that there is no liability for them to provide services to you, and there is no guarantee that those services will be provided to you. You'd hope they would be, because they'd make themselves pretty unpopular if they didn't, but it is something to be aware of. I will put my hand up here and say that I do have a Gmail account, and I quite like it. And it's got lots of messages going back a long way. I also have my own email server infrastructure that I run at home on my servers, and I'm happy with both of those. Yeah, you can. You can get a piece of software that will turn Gmail into a storage solution. You can put files and stuff up there. I can't remember what it's called. G Drive or something. Oh, there's some piece of software that lets you store and retrieve files off Gmail. However, don't expect your account to still be active if you put too much stuff up on there that isn't sanctioned, because if they do happen to go through your mailbox, I think they do have the right to remove software that breaches their terms of service. Now, I don't think I need to give you guys examples of an email address. It's user@domain. Okay, now, I mean, I think we've all done that.
I think we understand that one.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, and that's about it for Chapter 7. So unless anybody's got any questions, I'm going to stop recording, start this encoding, have some morning tea, and then get to work on the remote bundle here so that we can try and get that up sooner rather than later so that people can start knocking labs over. I will be around on Skype for about another 10-15 minutes, though, if anybody wants to catch me about anything. Has anybody got any other pending questions? Yeah, this seems to be the rage this year. There's all sorts of 09090909s. I got one at 08080808, and there was another one at 01, 02, at 03040607 0809 or something. There's been quite a number of them this year.
I'm looking forward to 11-11-11.
that will be pretty cool.
At 11-11.
11. Lots of ones.